So my computer says for me to say, I would like to take this opportunity to thank the organizers for giving me a chance. So this is a project that I'm going to talk about. So I guess I'll tell you a little bit how it came about. It's not really kind of the main direction of my lab, but it came about as a collaboration that kind of grew out still out of my postdoctoral work that I kept up over the years. But I think it might be relevant to people's interests here in the lab, in this workshop. And I would like to see if people have ideas and possibly some for some collaborative projects giving us some ideas on how to move forward on this project. So this is work, this is a collaboration between my lab and the laboratory of Judith Gervon, who is in Paris at CRNS at the Laboratoire de la Perception Psychologie. Generally, I told you guys about this 2 weeks ago, but I think actually
were any psychologie.
Pardon my French. I try. So my laboratory is interested in understanding the neuronal mechanisms for understanding audition in complex acoustic environments, and. I talked, how many people were at my talk 2 weeks ago? Oh, okay, so some people were here. Okay, so, but I'll give a brief overview of kind of the overview of our research. So our goal is to, does somebody have a laser pointer?
If you give me a minute, I can use
one. There was a stick.
You want the stick?
Yeah, the stick. So the goal of research in my laboratory is to identify the neuronal circuits in the central auditory pathway that support kind of natural audition and auditory perception. And so you could think of it as, you know, kind of the goal of our research is to understand how our sensory inputs translated into perceptual correlates. And we're particularly interested in understanding how changing the context under which acoustic stimuli are presented affects this transformation. So part of our I feel very powerful. So part of our research is trying to understand how different statistical structures of natural and unnatural sounds affect their processing within the auditory pathway. And we're also interested in understanding how experience shapes auditory processing. So we do most of our work in mice, where we found that the main directions in the lab is understand at the level of computation and analysis the neuronal coding strategies for representing natural sounds and vocalizations within the auditory cortex. We've also looked at the mechanism by which changing the statistical structure of sounds affects their representation in the cortex and the resulting behavioral responses. For example, as you move from more temporally sustained sounds, such as ringing sounds, to something that sounds like crackling fire, how would that affect neuronal representation? And is there actual adaptation in the pathway to match the statistical structure of the environment? And we also showed that auditory fear conditioning affects auditory perceptual acuity, and we're starting to identify the circuit that has to do with the feedback between the auditory cortex, the inferior colliculus, and also the amygdala that supports this transformation.
One question here.
Yeah.
If you say context like crackling fire or something like that, you see this as the primary signal or as a background?
Yes. So that's, I'll talk about that a little bit. So far what we have done is we would like to look at representation of several sound, several sound sources. So far what we have done is presented sounds with different statistical content and looked at how the prior statistical content of sounds affects the encoding of sound, you know, current encoding of sounds. But we would very much like to connect this to understanding, for example, how are signals, two signals that are, you know, concurrently with different statistical structure processed concurrently, or if you have a target against a noise signal, if that noise has some specific correlation structure, does that help identify the target? So there are some studies from human psychophysics, you know, that support that, but at the level of neuronal circuits, we really don't have an understanding. And I also want to add that kind of the state of the field right now is that for the responses of neurons throughout the auditory pathway to specific sounds, such as pure tones or frequency modulation sweeps, are really well characterized and understood. But as soon as we change anything on about how those sounds are presented, for example, if there is a noisy background or two sounds are presented concurrently, our understanding falls apart. And the kind of underlying premise of our work is that if we look at the neuronal population responses, that should give us much more richer information for understanding what the actual representation is and if there is and kind of what is the basis for auditory scene analysis. So we combine many techniques. We use electrophysiological recordings throughout the auditory pathway to collect responses of neuron populations of neurons. We use calcium imaging so that we can record neuronal activity simultaneously from populations of hundreds of neurons. And we can subject mice to different behavioral tasks so that we can connect that to their behavioral responses. And we also use optogenetic techniques, which allow us, if we have a specific prediction from modeling for the function of particular inhibitory neurons, we can test then the function of those inhibitory neurons. And we also have a clinical model in the lab of Tsinitas, and kind of part of our research is to translate our basic science findings to understanding the basis for tinnitus. So tinnitus is ringing in the ears, and and it's thought to affect more central auditory representations. It starts with damage to the cochlea, but it persists through the actual percept of tinnitus. It's thought to be generated by abnormal activity in central auditory structures, and so we're trying to pinpoint that. But what I'm going to talk about today is a collaboration that's sponsored by the Human Frontiers in Science program, which supports intercontinental work. And this is work on trying to apply these computational and kind of more detailed circuit level approaches, trying to think of ways to apply that to understanding the development of speech processing in infants. So there is obviously kind of a gap between our work and the goal of this project. And so I'll tell you about some progress that we made, and I'm open to you know, your suggestions for how we can move forward. So infants are sensitive to speech. So speech is a very special auditory stimulus for humans. But the question that we asked is, and I think this has been raised throughout this workshop, is how did the sensitivity to speech come about? And is it true sensitivity to speech sounds? Or is it that our auditory system is already sort of optimized for particular spectrotemporal transformations in acoustic signals, and speech kind of evolved to capitalize on that sensitivity so that the acoustical structure of speech is sort of relies or in a way you could say maybe optimally matches the capability of the human auditory system to process sounds more generally. So, you know, that's kind of an abstract philosophical idea, but we try to kind of start from that and then simplify things to see whether, in fact, the specialization for speech extends to other sounds. And in fact, it's true that infants are sensitive to speech. Infants are also sensitive to music. So because it's early in the morning, I'm going to play you this clip to illustrate.
Another song, in the keys.
You guys
very early in the development, right, we have this sensitivity for particular types of sounds, right? And speech is one of them.
Nevertheless, the official knowledge, opinion, whatever, result is that infants start at the age of 4, be able to move in rhythm. Probably
4 months, you mean, or
4 years?
Oh, 4 years. Okay.
Because those were not 4 years, I don't know.
Right.
But they were moving. Probably the difference. No, this is what they say in the literature.
Right.
And but probably the difference is to entrain to any frequency, any period.
That's true. Yeah.
Like animals. There's long discussion whether Kakadu or snowbird was able to entrain to different rhythms or not. So maybe that's the difference. But of course, babies are able to.
They respond to music. They respond to music. They respond to speech. And but it turns out that they're actually, this class of sounds that they're preferentially attended to is actually quite rich. So there is speech, there is music. It turns out they also have special attention for animal vocalizations. Something that they wouldn't know is associated with cute little or scary big animals. But one of the issues that we had when we looked at these studies is that the comparisons are very primitive. So kind of to establish, or somewhat, I shouldn't say very, but to establish speech preference, you present speech, but you can compare that to something like white noise or, whistle language or tones. So something kind of on the other end of the, if you think of the whole space of all possible sounds, here you have speech, and you're comparing it to something that's very far away that lacks a lot of the structure. And what we kind of wanted to do through this project is bridge across and try to understand the complexity of kind of the entirety of natural sounds and how they related to various stages of brain development and whether that transformation then is related to speech development. And we also wanted to understand what guides this preference, and kind of my favorite idea in neuroscience is efficient coding hypothesis. The efficient coding hypothesis postulates that our processing, the brain is kind of, is developed to efficiently or optimally process the available stimuli. So an example of something like efficient coding would be, for example, contrast adaptation. So if you look at if you have a narrow range of stimuli, the neurons at the level of the retina and throughout the auditory pathway are going to scale their dynamic range to match that particular distribution of stimulus intensities. Or by contrast, if this distribution is very broad, then this response function is going to rescale to match the broader contrast. And this is shown, you know, this is a very simple example. So, you know, if you walk into this room from the bright outside, it takes a little while, but your eyes are going to be adjusted to the dim level of light. But you can take it to much more complex kind of levels of representation. So, for example, if all you hear are, you know, so with loudness it's kind of obvious, but you can imagine that, for example, bandwidth resolution, if you need to, if the sounds are within a particular bandwidth, you might expect to have higher resolution communication signals within that particular bandwidth than with other bandwidths. So kind of redistribute your responses.
There are even indications that there is encoding of phonemes in the first, in the ribbon synapse already. In animals, I think those were probably mice. Presenting ma and pa. This was an experiment of my friend of mine, Tobias Moser, following some other experiments, almost 20 years ago. So they presented ma and pa to whatever animals, and realized that the response was very different. Although the signal, the R in the end, is the same, only the beginning is different. And so the spike rate that was found earlier was different in the two cases. And Tobias Moser and his student realized that this was present already in the ribbon synapse.
I see. Okay. So that would be right. So even in animals,
usually use
exactly. So that could very well. And we had a talk last week by Nick Lasica, who recorded in the inferior colliculus and found very precise responses to speech sounds in the inferior colliculus. So that could very much plays into this idea that the auditory system is predisposed.
Yeah.
To optimally process speech sounds,
yeah.
And you know, and that could, you know, very well figure into this idea of how did language evolve. Well, language evolved to optimally drive the hardware that was already there.
Yeah.
You know,
but the hardware already at a very early
exactly
stage,
because right? In mice, you know, that would mean that the common some common ancestor.
Are there speculations for why, I mean, I can see how it would be useful for humans, but why this hardware would have been there in animal models?
Well, so that's our idea that this actually already might come just from, you know, if you have the optimal filters for environmental sounds and animal vocalizations, that same set would translate to speech.
So maybe our speech is really onomatopoeia.
Right. Exactly.
There are some
exactly.
studies where they analyze the spectral and temporal modulations of animal sounds compared to speech, and they're at least compared to say just regular background noise. Stimuli, but the spectral and temporal modulations are
more similar.
The same
more similar.
Okay.
Right. So maybe anyhow we share many things with animals, and so we share the ability of distinguishing, having synapses that are able to distinguish phonemes.
Right.
Mice don't make use of it, but
right.
we develop
exactly.
language because we have other
right. Because we could. We develop language because we could. You
and
know, but
so
that
language,
was already.
Made use of this.
Right, exactly. So that's, that's exactly right. So I wasn't aware of that study. If you could email it me.
Yeah,
to
it's
me,
Elgott, 1982. Those were. Spike rates and
Moore
and Boydner, I think 2000.
Okay, I'll get it from you later. Yeah. So first, we wanted to kind of get a grip on somehow think about how would we characterize the complexity of environmental sounds and the statistics of environmental sounds in the natural world. And the idea is that we want to build some sort of simplified representation of the natural world. So in vision, of course, you know, there is some intuitive decomposition of visual images where, for example, you have this complex you know, image, but you can identify some edges, some contrast transformations within this image. And to some extent, it's effective. To other extents, it's less effective to reproduce. You know, it's hard to reproduce this such a scene based on the edges, but you can see that it captures some statistics. So we first we looked at the water sounds. So we did some recordings of just different kinds of water sounds. And this is my work, and this was work with Marcelo Magnesco, who will be here, I think, next week. So I was a physics fellow at Rockefeller in a very much similar kind of group, the Physics and Biology Center at Rockefeller. And so this is where we started this work. So this is a typical sound of water, and it turns out that one thing we observed about the sound is that it exhibits very interesting level of scale invariance, and within both its temporal structure and also spectral structure. So, and this is something that has been described before for some aspects of speech sounds. Some aspects of music, so there is this temporal scale invariance. And for water sounds, we actually played them back. So if you play the same water sound, but you either play it slowed down or accelerated, it still sounds like a water sound. So even without shifting the frequency content up and down, it just basically sounds the same. It's a fractal. It's like it's a fractal.
What's the spectrum of your water sound?
It's broadband. So it's.
Is it 1/f or 1/f?
It's 1/f. Yeah. It's 1/f.
I mean, scale invariant.
Could be different things. So I'll show you.
No, it's fine. But works only in a certain range of exponents.
Ah.
So, 1/f² is no longer self-similar or scaling invariant.
Yeah. So the question is to what degree, like how precise is it? So here I use it loosely to just describe. So imagine if you have a signal, right? And so you have a sound waveform, and you take that sound waveform and you stretch it out, and you play it back. It still sounds like a water sound. Okay. And then you compress it, and it still sounds like a water sound. So effectively, you are looking at it at different levels of resolution, right? So that's kind of what I want to just, what I mean by that. The strict parameters are, I think it is 1/f, but it turns out it's not that important. But I'll show you the feature that's very important. So, So we thought that maybe if we build on the scale invariant sounds, we try to make an artificial sound that has the scale invariant property. And we composed the sound where we took gamma tone, like basic just single gamma tones that were distributed uniformly in log frequency space and were presented at some specific rate just randomly. But the key feature was that they had the same number of cycles in the high frequency and the low frequency range. So that means that in low frequency, these gamma tones were much slower, and in high frequencies, they were much faster. Because, right, if the number of cycles is the same, then at high frequency, it's going to be much faster. And so if you compose a sound, if you compose a waveform using this property, this is what it sounds like. Um, So my graduate student at the time told me that he can't listen to this anymore because it makes him want to go to the bathroom. But it's, you know, it sounds very naturalistic, right? And so then we wanted to see, well, how far can we generalize? So we really, in this model, we only have two parameters. We have the rate at which these chirps, you know, we can call them chirps, are presented, and we have the number of cycles, so the cycle decay time constant. Everything else is completely random, okay? And we tried to vary those parameters, and we asked human subjects just to tell us whether those sounds sound natural or unnatural. And it turns out that there is some range of these parameters. So this is changing the different rate, and the different values here are the changes for this decay cycle constant, okay?
And rate so means how many chirps per...
How many chirps per second. Second. Yeah. So, well, in this case, I don't know why, but I have them in hertz per octave, but okay. Basically, yeah, chirps per second per octave, okay? And I also have, I have them in random amplitude, so the amplitude also has this, you know, I think the amplitude has 1 over probability of different amplitudes is 1 over a squared, with the idea that then the power would be, would have 1 over x. So for a range of these q parameters, you get a natural percept, and when we ask subjects to identify what that percept sounded like, it, you know, they would always come up with some sort of water-like descriptions. So like brook or pattering rain or dripping water. So it's, you get different kind of different sound, different water-like percepts. Now, what happens if you break the scale invariance? So what we did is we constructed the sounds in the exact same way, but instead of having a constant decay cycle time constant, we just put in an actual time constant of decay. So each chirp was the same exact length in different frequency bands. So then the high frequency chirps had many more cycles, right? They were ringing much longer. And then this percept of naturalness completely disappears. So if we take away the scale invariant feature, then this percept goes away. But it turns out that the spectral composition was less important. So if we go from, we had this log frequency distribution to just uniform linear frequency distribution, then it almost sounds natural, or it sounds natural for most subjects, and there is kind of, it's important for these sounds to be broadly distributed in frequency space. If we restrict them to a specific subset of space, then they no longer sound natural. So it's important that it's really, truly broadband. So after we did this work, somebody pointed out to us that in fact it's actually quite similar to this more general idea that was suggested by Smith and Lewicki, who did analysis of a whole range of sounds and tried to come up with a sparse basis for representing different kinds of sounds. And in this case, this is a speech-like sound. And the representation here shows the amplitude and the center frequency of a wavelet, where of a wavelet decomposition of a speech sound. So instead of a spectrogram, so we are used to seeing spectrograms of speech, but instead here they have this kind of unitary, a sparse representation. And in a way that's very appealing, especially from the efficient coding hypothesis, because it gives you a much lower parameter representation, right? You're reducing your number of parameters for representing speech sounds. So, Ralph, that's why I was asking you yesterday about how you're representing the speech sounds, right? So it seems that you're also projecting them into some sort of basis, right, before processing them. So this, I guess, could be one of the such bases. But if you look at the actual, you know, little wavelets that they use to project speech, they're very similar to what we use to construct this water-like sounds. And they definitely have also this feature that they scale in time with the frequency. And so...
And to be clear, that's not a wavelet basis that they're using. That's, they use unsupervised learning to learn the shape,
to learn the shape of
the statistics of
natural sounds. Yeah, yeah. But then they come up, the basis that they get...
Yeah, it looks very much like frequency.
Yeah. So that's kind of part of our future research program. So we thought that this was promising because then we could use this basis, this gamma tone basis, to identify correlations or kind of to identify some statistical properties of speech sounds and then relate them to this gamma tone basis. But first we wanted to see whether we can translate this research to understanding infant perception. And we wanted to see, are infants in fact sensitive to this scale invariant property in sounds? So we designed the task. So it's, all this research is very cute because babies are adorable. And, well, especially if they're not your own baby. Or, you know, sometimes your own baby is also adorable. But anyway, so, but yeah, you just, basically they work with babies both neonatal, so just as they're born, or when they're 4 to 8 months of age. And what can you, you can't ask them to tell you, does the sound sound natural or does it not sound unnatural? So we use for psychophysics, we use this habituation switch task design, which is fairly complicated, but it's pretty robust task, where essentially you present a visual stimulus and the baby looks at that stimulus, and then you play different sounds to them, and the you measure the looking time at your of the baby at the visual stimulus. When the when the babies get bored, they stop, they start looking away, so their eyesight starts wandering, and so you can kind of correlate whether they're interested or bored by measuring their looking time. Okay. And that can tell you whether there can tell the difference in the statistical structure of sounds if you design the task correctly. So Judith is really a master of this habituation switch task design. It involves this kind of very complex rearranging of stimuli. So essentially, you construct this what is called chimeras stimuli. So these are different instances of, say, scale invariant or variable scale sounds, where you switch the parameters. So I don't know if I have the audio here. Here's an example. So I think actually this was the alternating sound. So at first you heard water sound, then it switched to a kind of more staticky sound, then it switched back to water sounds, but with different parameters. So you can either present those things in sequence, so all water sounds, or you can switch between water sounds and variable scale sounds and then water sounds. And in one case, it's non-alternating block. In another case, it's alternating block. So first, you play a whole bunch of these scale invariant sounds, and you wait for the baby to habituate to them. So that means that they're no longer respond, you know, no longer interested in them. And then you test them by either putting a scale invariant sound first. So of course they don't know that this is the testing part, this is just part of the stimulus design. Or you put the variable scale sound first, and then you switch to scale invariant sound. And then you have the, this would be the alternating block, okay? Or you habituate them to variable scale sounds first, and then you again test them with exact same sounds. So essentially, you're comparing how much, whether having the scale invariant sounds or variable scale sounds, whether the looking time to this is affected by whether they just heard this block or that block before. Does that make sense? Okay. So now let's see. So in this, so what do we find? So we find that after we habituate them to the scale invariant sound, there is a difference in their looking time to scale invariant versus variable scale sounds. However, if we habituate them to variable scale sounds, there is no difference in their looking time to variable scale versus scale invariant sounds. So in a way, what this means is that the scale invariant sounds, the way we interpret it is that they're able to form a category of scale invariant sounds. So even though they sound all very different, they can tell when there is a transition from those sounds to very different, you know, variable scale sounds. But they can't in the other direction. So they would never, they never identify a common statistical feature in variable scale sounds. So this suggests that the infants can form a category of scale invariant sounds, but they can't quite form a category of variable scale sounds. So the variable scale sounds kind of just sound, you know, staticky to them. So we wanted to see whether there is that a differential representation in the brain for the scale invariant sounds. And so Judith runs her experiments in the hospital in the neonatal floor where she recruits infants to do to image their brain non-invasively using this F-NIRS technique that I think we heard about last week. And essentially the way it works is you place these probes over the brain of the infant, very close, you know, there has to be very good contact with the skin, and you just place them back in the bassinet and play a bunch of sounds to them. And they usually actually drift to sleep, okay? So this is what it looks like. So,
does the data look different when they're awake? Huh? Does the data look different when they're awake versus asleep, I assume?
Well, because they move so much and this is very noisy signal, you can pretty much only use the data when they're, you know, calm. Awake is probably nice.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do when they're awake. I don't know if they're these are really, really young babies, like 2 to 4 days old. So and the way these probes work is that there is a source that shines light on the cortex and there are a bunch of detectors. So in fact they capitalize on the fact that several detectors are picking up the emitted light. And they're measuring oxy versus deoxy hemoglobin. So essentially it's a measure of oxygenation in the blood flow. which somehow is related to brain activity, but you know, it's not, there isn't a one-to-one correspondence. So in adults, if you play a brief tone, this is going to be your response. And each dot here is time in seconds. So this is very slow response. This is for oxy versus and deoxy. So these are not very you know, precise measurements. And for me, as an electrophysiologist who's used to spikes from, you know, this little region in the cortex, it's kind of a big adjustment to looking at these data. But they can reveal some aspects to us. And in fact, it would be impossible to get this data otherwise, because, you know, of course, we can't stick electrodes into the infant's head, and you can't do anything. You know, there's nothing invasive that you could possibly do. You can't even put them into the fMRI machine because it's very loud and uncomfortable. So so it's really kind of the only way to do that.
So for the bold, I think the typical time resolution is 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Get below, and this should be similar here.
Yeah, so it's roughly similar, yeah. So, okay, so again, this is our stimulus design. So we use these variable scale invariant and variable scale sounds, where we took the same exact matrix of parameters for the chirps, where the chirps were distributed in time and frequency, in log frequency uniformly. And then we had exactly matched set, where the only difference was that in the scale invariant case, the chirps had constant number of cycles, and in the variable scale case, the chirps had the same temporal length. So we had, again, this block design where you had either a scale invariant block or scale invariable and variable scale block, or only variable scale block, or variable scale alternating with scale invariant. So we can compare essentially responses scale invariant versus variable scale, or alternating and non-alternating blocks. And there is only so many trials that you can run in infants, and so that's kind of why we use this design. So you can't really expect to record neuronal activity, you know, in response to one particular, we just don't have statistical power to compare, for example, to this 3-second stimulus versus this 3-second stimulus. We have to really average over these fairly long blocks. Okay, so now what we're going to plot is for each sensor, okay, here, we can plot oxy and deoxy on alternating versus non-alternating blocks, right? So at the very least, we expect that there should be a different response there for these. So if there is a differential representation of scale invariant and variable scale sounds, at the very least, the responses on alternating and non-alternating blocks should be different. Okay, so that's our expectations. And so, I'll tell you a little about the analysis, because, of course, now we have many infants. I think, I forget whether I said somewhere how many infants we have. Okay, so we have 22 infants, okay? And you can imagine that this cap might be placed on slightly, you can't really match. Infants all have different shaped head, right? And it's, you know, there is a student who's placing these electrodes on their head. So they're not exactly matched. But at the same time, because the signal is so weak, it's not clear that we should discount any of these electrodes. So the signal gets averaged out over all of the infants, based on these sensors, and then we basically run the statistics to look for differences. So this is the summary of the data. I apologize for the clunky way of presenting it, but essentially we're looking for differences between the red and magenta trace or the blue and the cyan trace. And it turns out that there are some significant differences, but it's really restricted to just one channel. You know, there's some differences on other channels, but we just don't have the statistical power to pick them out. And it turns out that on this channel, there is, in fact, statistically different responses on alternating versus non-alternating blocks. And in fact,
the previous was an average over all 22 subjects.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So channel two, even though it might be placed in different places on different subjects.
So in the same subject, you don't have statistical power to do the analysis. Yeah. And so in the channel two, there might be, you know, variation, quite significant. You know, it's a small scale, and these places are good. So, okay, so then we decided to, if we restrict our analysis to just, you know, the kind of frontal channels, okay, medial frontal channels, then we can identify there are several channels where, in fact, we see either significant differences in oxy or deoxy or both, on alternating and non-alternating blocks. And so you can see that, you know, it's, this is now significant activation on alternating blocks versus non-alternating blocks. So you can see that there is, on alternating blocks, there is significant activation of these channels. So basically there are differences in which channels are activated, exhibit significant activation on under these two conditions. And in fact, we could, you know, identify that there are differences in the hemisphere. There is actually more activity in the left hemisphere. There is, if we just kind of run a statistical test under temporal versus frontal, we can find a difference there. So there are differences for, and we expect, of course, greater activation on alternating blocks. So we could make some conclusions about that. I'm a little reluctant to say kind of, you know, to interpret it as, oh, this means that scale invariance is encoded in the left temporal lobe, you know. But it is at least promising that there is differential activation. And in fact, if we look on non-alternating blocks, there is differential activation patterns evoked by scale invariant blocks versus variable scale blocks. And in fact, the scale invariant blocks seem to drive greater amount, right? There is more channels that show significant activity in during scale invariant blocks. So how would we summarize it? So we would say that scale invariance is a categorizable feature of natural sounds that we showed both for adults and for infants, and that the newborn brain exhibits sensitivity to scale invariant sounds. So now we're interested in kind of connecting this work to other research that we're doing in the laboratory. And a part of how we're thinking of doing it is connecting this to some studies that we did on specialization of the brain for auditory vocalizations. But I would love to hear if you have some ideas from, you know, the variety of work on either speech recognition or cochlear mechanics of how we can kind of push forward this idea. So what are the next stimuli that we should try to bridge kind of you know, to connect the statistics of environmental sounds to maybe to speech sounds. You know, how should we do that? Let's see, so what time is it? So I can tell you maybe another story about the neuronal basis for vocalization, or the neuronal specialization for vocalizations. Is that, would that be interesting? Yeah, okay. So, okay. So we were interested in, we work with rodents, so with mice and rats, and we were interested in this question of, is there a specific representation, specialized representation of their conspecific vocalizations? And so Sarah told you about her work last week, Sarah Woolley, on the brain specialization for the songbird signals, right? And there is a lot of work in the songbird literature, and the kind of studies that she does is really they allow you to very nicely, you know, manipulate all these variables. You know, our work is a little more cruder, but we justify it because it's work in mammals, so might be more directly relevant for understanding, I guess, human sound processing, maybe. So rats, I don't know how many of you know that, but they communicate using these high frequency calls in the ultrasonic range. So we usually don't hear them. In fact, they have one call in the audible range, which if some of you have ever handled a rat might have heard, and that's a distress call. It's a very boring call. But their calls in the ultrasonic range are much more beautiful or more interesting. And so I can play them to you here.
Scale down,
exactly. So scale down and slow down, yeah. And this is work of Isaac Caruthers, who graduated from my lab a few years ago, Ryan Natan, who just graduated, and Diego Laplani, with whom I started this work, who was at Rockefeller University a few years ago. He's now in Brazil. Okay, so, sorry. So we got interested in this, thinking about this question of temporal invariance in sound object representation. So there is this idea that there is this idea of hierarchical organization within the auditory pathway. So there are many brain areas, and the higher you go in the brain area, the more the representation becomes less about the acoustical features and more about the meaning of sound. So you could think that, for example, for speech, you're not representing frequency and temporal modulation range, but at some point you're going to represent the actual word, right? So how do you know that the representation becomes that? And one of the ways to know that is that you can vary those acoustic parameters and test whether the representation becomes more invariant to those changes. And people have tried to test this kind of in conjunction with this idea that there is a preference for conspecific vocalizations in animals and in many different animal models. And the findings are, I kind of wish Sarah had opened with this description, is that the findings were controversial. And it wasn't clear whether this is, you know, about the species that was used or the way the animal was raised or, you know, something else. But there was a study from the marmoset auditory cortex where they presented the natural marmoset calls and looked at the neuronal responses. And you can see that this neuron, so this is the call and this is the response, exhibits, you know, this is the firing rate, you know, over 100 hertz. This neuron is like super excited about this call. when those calls were either slowed down, accelerated, or reversed, these responses decreased. So the same neuron responded very differently and much more strongly when these calls were slowed down or accelerated. So it's acoustically distorted. And over the population of neurons, the response to the natural call was much greater than the responses to slow down or accelerated calls. So then they asked, well, okay, that's fine. You know, this is a marmoset call presented to a marmoset, but maybe the specificity is not just restricted to just marmoset calls. Maybe it's for any animal localization. So
one question. So you said, I mean, this is like single neurons or several?
These are multi-electrode, like kind of, you know, use these bundles. So
my question is, so if you would like accelerate the sound, so could we expect that there's like other neurons which would then answer?
Well, that's why they averaged over a bunch of neurons. So this is a population. Neuronal population average. So then on average, there's still more responses to the natural calls than to slow down or accelerated call. So yeah, so, but that's a very valid question.
I mean, I asked because one of the, say, basic problems is speech recognition speaking rate. So,
right.
And also you have certainly a variation in pitch, or in, like in vocal
right.
tract length, so the resonances,
right.
Vocal resonances are varying, but certainly in a given range, so.
Right.
So, what else?
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so then they did this. They did the recording in the cat, in the same brain area, the cat, and in the marmoset, and they presented marmoset calls, either the original calls, or actually it says fast, but these were reversed calls. And they compared the firing rate to the natural and to the reversed calls. And it turns out that in the marmoset, almost all neurons are below the identity line, right? So they respond much stronger to the natural calls than to the reverse calls. But in the cat, it's roughly equidistributed, okay? So if you do a histogram of the selectivity index, which is just the difference divided by the sum, you have much stronger selectivity in the marmoset for marmoset calls than in the cat for marmoset calls, okay? Okay.
And the marmoset calls are reversed or they're sped up?
Sorry, it says fast, but it's reversed.
Okay.
So is there any predator-prey relationship between the two?
Well, not these two, because these were raised in colonies.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't know how much marmosets encounter cats in the wild. I really don't know. But certainly the study to me leaves a lot of questions, right? Because it's just kind of an all random, right? It's an all random. So then people tried to exert more controls. And so, of course, in our field, you probably already noticed, everybody has their, you know, preferred model system. So Jan Schnoop, with Andy King, they used guinea pigs, okay? So they took guinea pigs and they played to guinea pigs marmoset calls, natural or reversed, but they decided to introduce a clever manipulation. They were going to take a group of these guinea pigs and train them to discriminate these marmoset calls so that they would become more behaviorally relevant to them. And it turns out, this is, I think, after learning, and this is subcontrol, there was still no difference with learning. So the behavioral relevance didn't make a difference to these animals.
Different dogs or different animals or different trials?
Sorry, these were ferrets. These were ferrets. Huh?
The different dogs are different animals or
different
trials?
Neurons. Different neurons.
Different neurons.
Yeah, different neurons. So I would imagine many animals, right? Because there are many dogs. So they probably had like 8 animals, something like that. So this was in the ferret. Okay, so then another group took guinea pigs. And they played guinea pigs calls to guinea pigs. And in guinea pigs, they looked at both the temporal precision and the firing rate. And it turned out that they did it in the thalamus anesthetized animals, cortex anesthetized animals, and cortex of awake animals. And they saw no difference when they reverse these calls. So is it something special about the marmosets that they care about the reverse marmoset calls? We don't know, right? So I wanted to have a more systematic approach to this problem. And we focused on the rat conspecific vocalizations. So rats make these high frequency calls. And so there's some complexity to them, but there's also, they're not that complex, but they're somewhat complex. And what appealed to me about them is that they're actually quite parameterizable because they really just sound like whistles. So you always have some dominant frequency that kind of is modulated over time. And I already mentioned that they also have this extremely boring 22 kilohertz call, but we didn't use it in the study. So if I zoom in into a couple vocalizations that we collected, you can see that there is this modulation in frequency over time, but essentially it's just kind of like a single dominant tone. So the first thing we did was we took 8 of these vocalizations and presented them to the rat. And you can see that they, a priori, they look very similar to each other, right? But the neuronal responses are very different. So here I'm presenting to you the spikes of these neurons over time for 100 repeats of each of these vocalizations. And you can see that there is a subset of the vocalizations that evoke very precise responses. And so these are the very selective responses of these neurons, and in fact, we can calculate the selectivity. We can first just quantify them. So this is for one neuron that's sensitive to these two vocalizations, and another neuron is sensitive to another subset of vocalizations. And you can just kind of quantify how many of these vocalizations are neurons sensitive to. Well, it turns out that most of them actually don't distinguish much, but the ones that distinguish are sensitive to a couple of, don't respond much to vocalizations, but the ones that do respond to some subset of vocalizations. Can we predict their responses to these vocalizations? So my background is in the retina, as I told you before, and in the retina, I worked in, I did my PhD in Marcus Maestri's lab, where our goal was to quantify the response properties of retinal ganglion cells to temporally varying visual scenes using a very systematic approach that has its basis in white noise analysis. And so it relies on calculating a receptive field, a spectrotemporal receptive field in this case, for a neuron that's passed through some sort of nonlinear function and then some probabilistic module to predict the spike timing, and then we predict the spike timing. And so we use this framework, it's called the linear nonlinear framework, to estimate the sensitivity, to build a model for neuronal responses, and then we can use this model to predict neuronal responses to a new sequence of vocalizations and see how well it does. So if we take this, we need to construct a stimulus to train this model, okay? So in this case, we took a whole bunch of these vocalizations and concatenate them into a 30-second long stimulus. And we know that mice usually make this chirp at about 10 hertz. And so that's the rate that we use to concatenate these vocalizations. And when we look at neuronal responses to these vocalizations, they're actually highly, you can see very sharp peaks, kind of similar to what Nick showed for the IC responses to speech sounds, okay? Other neurons also exhibit these sharp, temporally regular responses, but there is a lot of noise in between. So then we wanted to, we used half of our data to train, half of the temporal sequence to train the model, and then we used the last half to test how well it predicts. We developed a parametrization of the stimulus that relied on separating frequency, identifying the dominant frequency component, and then measuring the frequency modulation in that component over time, and the amplitude. So we effectively had just two parameters, a space, a two-dimensional space to describe the stimulus. That varied in time. So we had a trace of frequency modulation over time, and I mean amplitude modulation and frequency modulation over time. Or we also tested a more standard model, kind of more like what Shihab presented, that's built on the spectrogram of the stimulus. Now, the spectrogram of the stimulus has a huge number of parameters, right? Because you encode the amplitude within each spectral band separately over time. So in a way, this gives you a very, I mean, to me, that seems like a very clunky representation of a stimulus that could be described by just two parameters that are varied in time. So we calculated the linear kernels using this information maximization approach. And also we built in a nonlinearity, which in this case, we just used a simple quadratic nonlinearity for predicting neuronal responses. And so now for these two models, if we took a sound waveform and looked at how well we could predict the measured response, it turned out that the two parameter model could actually give a very accurate prediction for the neuronal responses. Whereas if we use the spectrogram representation of the stimulus, it gave a much worse prediction. And we could see this over all the neurons that we recorded. If we look at the prediction accuracy, it was much higher, was statistically higher, but for a select group of neurons, it was actually very highly predictive, whereas the spectrogram representation was not at all.
Right, when I look at your STRF predictor there, there are a lot of the right shape that it's getting.
Right.
But it seems to have some sort of scaling.
Yeah, this is kind of...
Is it an issue of scaling with it, or like...
And there is also an offset. I think the problem is that you're just trying to fit slightly bad parameters. So in a way, if you go from the spectrogram, if you go from the spectrogram to this representation, you have a kind of slightly nonlinear, because first you have to identify the dominant frequency component, and then you take the frequency modulation over time and the amplitude modulation. So in reality, you could think of this model as a nonlinear, linear, nonlinear model. And I think that's what gives you improved power in your prediction. So then we wanted to get back to this idea, well, what happens if we compare the natural representation to the reversed, accelerated, or time compressed or time extended versions? And it turns out that there was a significant decrease in the response strength of these neurons to compressed, dilated, or reversed vocalizations. So this is consistent with previous studies, but of course, the effect is much less strong than in this first marmoset study that I showed you. But it's still actually pretty, it's very significant, and there is still a strong effect. But it also turns out that the model prediction accuracy drops from when you go from the original to either compressed, dilated, or reversed representation of the stimulus. So we interpreted, I mean, we're, you know, we don't want to overinterpret this result, but to me what it suggests is that kind of similar to what Theo brought up before, that the structure of these filters that the auditory system is using is matched to the statistical dynamics or statistical range of the actual vocalizations. So this is just when we train them on the, whether we train them on these vocalizations or we use the different subset to train. So the study showed that the neurons in the auditory cortex respond selectively to the conspecific vocalizations, and that that these responses are predicted by a model that relies on frequency modulation and amplitude modulation in the responses, that the transformed vocalizations evoke lower responses, but that also correlates with the lower prediction accuracy of this linear nonlinear model, which suggests to us that the auditory system is kind of matching its processing to the statistics of the natural vocalizations. I have kind of another part of this talk, but I can also break if you guys want to break.
I have some questions.
Yeah.
Again, back to that slow-fast comparison. Do you have some data on, say, the variation in the rates you would see?
You know, maybe I'll show you the next part of the talk, because that kind of talks a little more about it. So there is this idea, I didn't show you this introductory slide, but I have an introductory slide that says, like, why are we studying the auditory cortex? And the idea is that if somebody says the word neuron, it activates distinct frequency bands within and distinct channels within the cochlear that then travel through the auditory pathway. But at the level of the auditory pathway, it's integrating this information across this frequency distributed channels to actually provide you with some sort of more coherent representation. And now what happens when you have many different people say this word? This representation is actually very different, but if we expect the auditory cortex to provide invariant representation, it should still respond the same to different instances of that same word. I mean, this is very abstract kind of description, but that's kind of the basic idea. And there is also this idea.
Can this require that the processing, whatever, is linear, is some kind of super? When you're talking about spectral,
I'm simplifying.
Spectral channel? No, it's a question.
Right.
You have whatever spectral channels that you can combine, that superpose, this all requires linearity, right?
You could do, right, so you could both integration, so there is some linear integration, and there is some nonlinear processing, both at the level of single neurons and also in the cortex. So I kind of talked about it in my first talk more. There is excitatory inhibitory neurons that form interconnected feedback circuits. There's also, of course, feedback to all the earlier auditory pathways. So there is a lot of processing, but I agree with you that you do need to have linear integration of the inputs. Yeah, so there is feed-forward integration, but it's shaped by this nonlinear kind of feedback part of it. So there is this idea of kind of more of a more of a framework paper that postulated that as you go from the auditory nerve to the cochlear nucleus to the olivary complex and ferriculicus thalamus and finally the auditory cortex, the filters for representing the sound become less specific. There's kind of this trade-off between being less specific but increasing the feature, so more feature specific. And that by the time you get to the cortex, so these are the input layers and the output layers are specific to a large number of sub-features of the stimulus. So in the lower kind of brain regions, you have selectivity for very simple acoustic features. And as you move up, you become selective for combinations of features. And there is an idea that this is what helps create invariant representations of sounds. Now, I was actually very interested in your comment that you get generalization when you go through success. You need a deep network to build up generalizable interpretations. And I wonder whether at some level this kind of framework where you have these multiple successive levels with variable amount of selectivity kind of goes back to this.
First of all, this would relate to the area of, for example, speaker adaptation. Mm-hmm. So the problem you have demonstrated,
right.
Like several speakers speaking the same
right.
word, you want to still be able in each case to recognize the same word. So that would be speaker adaptation. Formally, this has been done mainly with linear transformations. So where you take some speaker data, either supervised or unsupervised, and try to adapt your features, which are very much still in a spectral or capsule domain, so at a very early stage, you try to do some linear transformations. If you have very few data, you can even just do this with a single parameter, where you effectively have a parameter which is looking at the vocal tract length. I think Inek also presented some of that.
Yeah.
With the neural networks, and you also certainly to be speaker independent, you just train on lots of different speakers. So for a large vocabulary system, you have like several hundreds of different speakers you train on to capture this variability also on the model level. Moving from these shallow Gaussian mixture-based systems to the deep systems, there's certainly we just by moving to neural networks, to deep neural networks, we have more genericity to some level. But we're still trying to further improve by developing also specific adaptation methods.
Okay.
And this is very much ongoing work. So we can still apply linear transformations of the input.
Uh-huh.
And we also and also others did studies like, I mean, each layer is like you have a weight matrix and you can try to adapt that weight matrix. And so you can try to do it on the input layer, you can try to do that at some hidden layer, you can try to do that at the output layer. Currently, evidence shows that it's slightly more important to do that at a lower level, so input or first hidden layer. But it's also still ongoing. There's a lot of technical issues to follow. There's also approaches which try to get, it's called I-vector approach, where you try to get some global statistics. So you take like a whole segment or several segments of the same speaker and you try to train like a single, more or less sparse vector which indicates somehow global statistics about the speaker.
Uh-huh.
You can do that with neural networks, but you can also do that with singular value decomposition approaches. And then you actually feed that vector as additional input, although it's a constant input over, say, the whole segment you want to recognize. You still feed that as an additional input to your neural networks. And there's also works like looking, do you do that on the input layer, or do you again do that at different inner layers? And it also gives you additional improvements. But there's, adaptation still is ongoing work. So there's certainly to be expected that active adaptation also plays a role. Uh-huh. So not only, say, the genericity of the whole approach and the depth of the network, but also, say, a dynamic reaction to speaker changes and corresponding adaptation.
Danny Almonds has some really interesting work where they trained conventional deep neural networks for his vision, for classification, and they, parametrically go through and introduce more invariance properties to the problem. So, taking objects and starting to move objects, trying to rotate objects, the classical problems of invariant visual recognition. And the interesting part of the results is, as they do that, the network has no idea about neuroscience, right? It's being trained for classification. Uh-huh. But as they do that and they look at the higher and higher layers of the network, the representations that are being formed of the stimulus there, they compare to electrophysiology on the same data sets in monkey. Uh-huh. And they see higher layers become much more predictive of responses in what we think of as the more more invariant areas of the visual pathway, IT and such.
Right.
So not only are they getting better for classification to all these variations.
So this is
be interesting to know something similar. I don't know of anyone that's tried to do the same thing for variations in speech, but I'm very interested to know if something similar happened.
Yeah, so this was very much inspired by this work. So my, actually a lot of it in vision was done by my colleague Nicole Rest and Jim DiCarlo. So if we look within the auditory cortex, there are many different sub-areas that can be identified. So with the primary auditory cortex and then the secondary sub-areas. And so the signal first goes to A1, and then it's thought to go to this area, SRIF, and to these other areas. So if we look at the differences in signal representation between these two areas, if we just look at the tuning curve, so this is how strongly a neuron responds to tones of different frequency and different intensity. You can see that here it's much sharper, whereas in the secondary auditory cortex, it's broader and more general. And if we look at the latency of the tone evoked responses, it's slightly more, slightly slower in SRIF. So it's really a more, that's kind of the evidence for it being secondary area. So we made up sounds where we took these vocalizations and we either accelerated them or slowed down, like in the last study. But we also transform them, either shifting in frequency up or down, or shifting in frequency up or down, in frequency modulation. So either having higher frequency modulation or lower frequency modulation. And this was possible because we already had parameterized them. So we had a frequency modulation over time vector. So we just scaled it by 2 and then translated that back into these vocalizations. Or we changed both slowed them down and compressed them in FM, or accelerated them and expanded them. So our prediction was that if we look at the representation of two different vocalizations by neurons, and now we take one dot is the response of a population of neuron, okay? We expect them to be discriminable, okay? So we could do some clustering on the responses to show that they can discriminate between these two vocalizations. And we can compare what happens to the original versus the transformed vocalizations. So our prediction is that if there is if the neurons are sensitive to the acoustic transformations, then the representation of the original and transformed vocalization will be very different, and the discriminability between these vocalizations will be difficult between the transformed vocalizations. Whereas in the area SRIF, we expect that, sorry, it's better explained this way. So if we want to discriminate between the original, two original vocalizations and the transformed vocalizations at the same time, based on the neuronal population responses, if we have not generalizable, so not invariant representation, then it's very hard to tell those responses apart. Whereas if there is high invariance, then these representations will be very distinct. So we'll be able to separate the responses to original and transformed vocalizations. So our prediction is that if we have higher generalization and measure the prediction accuracy for discrimination between original and transformed vocalizations, we'll have a lower, less of a reduction in the accuracy of the prediction if that brain area generalizes. Does that make sense? I don't know. So this is what our data looked like. So we had the original vocalizations then transformed. This is just from one neuron. We had responses to all those parameters, okay? And we also recorded this from SRAF. And here I'm just showing you one neuron, but we had hundreds of these neurons that we recorded from. So we matched these populations by firing rate to just make sure that we don't have some sort of specific effects, because the neurons in A1 exhibited normally higher firing rates. So we just selected the subset of those neurons that matched the firing rates in the higher auditory area. And we made sure that for individual USVs, these neurons, for the original, there is the same information content in this representation. Now, if we looked at the pairwise classification, we could see that there was pretty good classification depending on the number of neurons in the ensemble for both the primary auditory cortex and the secondary, although the classification improved in the secondary auditory cortex. So then we looked at how the classification accuracy was affected by the transformation of the vocalization. And for A1, you can see that there is a decrease in the performance accuracy. And for SRIF, there was also a decrease, but this decrease was actually much less. So if we looked at how this performance compared, the prediction accuracy compared, we could see that this is called something we call generalization penalty. So how much worse did the prediction become after the vocalizations were transformed? It was actually significantly lower for the secondary auditory cortex. So and as a function of population size, for A1, the generalization penalty was much stronger, although it's saturated at about 20 neurons. Sorry, for some reason I have this slide again. Okay, so this study, we established that there is provides some evidence for population code in this hierarchical representation of vocalizations. So when we go between the primary and secondary auditory area, even though neurons are equally selective for vocalizations and can discriminate them well, there is less of an impairment in discrimination in this higher secondary cortex with the acoustic disturbances of the sounds. So now we want to look at, if we look at these populations in primary and non-primary auditory cortex, whether the same kind of invariance can hold when we add background noise to these vocalizations for either their detections or discriminations. And you can talk, so Chris has collected some preliminary data. Our experiments are always, design is constantly changing because we're actually thinking of different things to test, but hopefully Chris will discuss that in the workshop next week. But basically we can see that there are robust responses to the vocalizations with and without background noise. And we can train, well, in this case, this was the rat. We could train the rat to detect the target and noise. Now Chris is training mice to detect some sounds in noise under different contrast levels. But we're basically trying to identify the neuronal mechanisms for this transformation in the representation. So let's see, so I guess I should do the thank you slide, in this case, my lab and my sources of funding, and also Judith Lab and her collaborators. So.
I would like to again come back to the question I wanted to ask. So there was one slide where you, at the earlier part of your presentation, where you varied, I think, the speed of sound. Mm-hmm. Where you had this distribution where the responsiveness was decreasing.
Ah, yes, side. Yes, yes.
Could you show that slide again? I have one question for that one.
So this one?
No. I think it was even much earlier. It was the first part
this
of
the
presentation.
Yeah, this is the first part. So maybe this one?
So you had like a histogram where you had like the responsiveness to the center. Maybe you can just browse through. Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't my work. Maybe it was...
This one, yes.
This one, okay.
Oh, the next one, the next slide.
This one.
I don't know.
I had this one. This one. Yes. Right.
Yes, right. So my question here is, so these were natural stimuli, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which were manipulated.
Right.
And my question is the decrease in responsiveness, does it go hand in hand with the distribution of the natural stimuli?
Yeah, so that's kind of what we tried to, so they didn't test it in this study, because you could say maybe it's just the acoustical parameters, and that's exactly, that was our prediction for our study, and we controlled for everything, right? In fact, we trained the model on the original sounds, but when we measured the responses to slow down or accelerated sounds, the responses went down, okay?
So,
and the model prediction went down. So it suggests that it's really it's not clear that it's the natural, whether it's natural or natural, but the it's sensitive to acoustical features.
Yeah, what I'm up to is the following. I mean, usually when we build up our systems, we have like our acoustic models, which
mm-hmm.
provide the connection between input and output. And we have the prior probabilities,
uh-huh.
which, as I pointed out yesterday, are very, very important for good performance. Now, you do not necessarily have this separation. So even currently, there's a lot of research going on trying to have joint models, so where you do not really distinguish between these two points,
uh-huh.
and which effectively might show a similar behavior. So, for example, if you have some, say, major stimuli, and you have like other stimuli which, say, abstractly speaking, say, move away from in some way, for example, moving away from, say, the average vocal tract length, for example, and then you would see like a proportional average distribution. And my interest here is So the responsiveness, does it really follow the distribution? So does it, in a way, model the probabilistic and the statistical distribution of the input?
Right, right.
Because information theory-wise, it would make a lot of sense.
Yes, of course, yeah. So so I don't have an answer for that, but that's a good question. We try to look at the frequency modulation spectrum of sounds, of vocalizations, and pick the sample vocalizations that cover that whole range. And we've also, when we distort them, we go outside the regime, and there is less responsiveness. But it's not, kind of what you're asking is actually more similar to what...
You would need like a collection of marmoset data where you would actually measure the variance.
So Sarah Woolley actually showed that, right? Sarah, were you there for Sarah Woolley's talks last week?
I think I've seen them.
So she shows this plot where she plots, it's not those parameters, but spectrotemporal density of the bird song calls for the two zebra finches and the other finch, and she shows the neuronal preference for all those parameters. Mm-hmm. And she shows that in the higher auditory area, there is a match between selectivity and the distribution of those parameters, but not in the input auditory areas.
But in that case, it was like you looked at different stimuli in a way.
Yes.
So I'm more like interested in the original problem you showed.
Right.
So you have people like saying the same word, but the characteristics of the input vary to several properties. Mm-hmm. And the question is, does the neural representation follow the corresponding distributions of these characteristics?
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah. To that point, though, I mean, they have the reversed vocalization, which ostensibly has all the same spectral and temporal features, just in a different order.
Yeah.
And they still see this, well, I guess it is controversial.
It's controversial.
Some studies they see it, some studies they don't.
I think that's, for me, that would even be another point, because that would be, say, specific, so the reverse is...
That's right, exactly.
That would be a specific property.
Specific statistical properties that matter. And some would be kept.
When you were talking, I was just trying to see if I find this, because I'm pretty sure at some point years ago I heard about some study where people were just like locally reversing phonemes and it was still audible speech.
Exactly. It's too bad Josh left, because he knows a lot about it. So you can, and there's some like something crazy like 20 or 40 milliseconds that you can switch them and it still sounds very natural.
But that, as I said, that would be like a different topic than
that's right.
Representation of the statistics.
Yeah.